Hello, today is October 7th, 2008. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's Continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Joan Craig. Our cameraman today is Dan McDermott from Natick Pegasus, and we are privileged to have with us today Carl J. Mueller. Welcome, Carl. Thank you for coming. May I ask you when you were born?
June 28th, 1921.
And where were you born?
Waltham.
And where do you currently live?
Waltham.
Have you lived there most of your life?
All your life.
And your marital status?
Yes.
Married?
Married.
For how long?
65 years.
Well, bless you. That's wonderful. Do you have children?
Two girls.
And any grandchildren?
I have six grandkids and two great-grandkids.
Congratulations. That's wonderful. Where and when did you enter the military?
Well, 1942, right after the war was declared, we were waiting for the recruiting office to open to sign up.
How old were you then?
22, 21 and a half, 22. 21, I guess. 21,
plus.
Almost 22.
And when you say we, did your friends do the same thing?
All the friends, my brother and all my friends, everybody we used to hang around with, they were all waiting to sign up.
You felt it was that important to join?
Positively.
What branch did you join?
Well, all of my friends were joining the Marines. My brother, they're all. So, well, previous to that, after high school, I went to night school and learned electric welding. After that, after I knew enough about the welding, I went down to Four River Shipyards and I was hired to weld. And I welded on the Wasp, the airplane carrier, the second one. The first one was bombed, the second one. The battleship Massachusetts, the destroyer, there's two or three destroyers were working on all those. But then all my friends were gone. They were all enlisted and they're all in the Marines, they're all over the place. So I said, what am I doing here? I'm the only one around here, so I left the deferment. I could have been deferred for the rest of the war. But I went down, the first place I went was the Marines. So they looked at me and all that, and they examined me and all that, and they said, we can't accept you. Now, this is 1942. So I said, what's the matter? My front teeth overlapped my bottom teeth by a fraction. And they said, we can't. I said, what? I'm not gonna bite the enemy. So then I went to the Navy, and it's the same thing. So then I went to the Army Air Corps, and they pulled me in.
They did. And talk about what is the Army Air Corps?
It was the Air Force before it started before the war, and these were all the planes that I flew B-24 Liberator. There's the B-17, the P-38, the P-51s, all those. So that's what the Army Air Corps. In 1946 or 47, Congress changed it so that now the Army Air Force come in, the Blues. And we were Army, so we were all done. And like I keep saying, the Army Air Corps, we did all the work. We dropped the bombs and we killed and all that stuff. And in 1945, the war was over. The Blues come in 1946 or 7. So I said, sure, we did all the work and they get the credit.
When you first joined the Army Air Corps, where were you sent for basic training?
I went to Fort Devens. And they lined us all up, and we had to take all our clothes off and put them in a bag. And my wife was there, and my father, and all that.
So you were married at that time,
I was married,
very young age, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, After I joined, we were getting ready to go overseas, and I come home on a furlough for about a month. We got married, and that was it. She came to me to Holyoke, Mass, where I trained, and after from there they sent me to New York. So then she came to New York, but I couldn't see her. We were restricted, and so she went home, and then I went overseas.
So you were first at Fort Devens.
Oh, Fort Devens was a training. Yeah, I mean first, and they examine you and all that stuff.
And then from there, where did you go?
Seymour Johnson Field, North Carolina.
Had you ever been to North Carolina before?
No.
What was it like? What was your first thoughts about
nothing.
It?
Nothing. I was with all the guys, you know, just nothing. My wife came down there to visit me to Seymour Johnson Field. And that's where we trained on for the turrets for the bombers, all the turrets that they have, you know, the bottom ball with the guns, the tail with the turret. That was the tail gunners were, then the front turret in the front, and I was on the top turret, and what they call, I was a flight engineer.
So did you have special training after basic to become a flight engineer?
Oh, definitely.
And was that in North Carolina?
Yes, Seymour Johnson Field. Then we went to Gunnerfield, Alabama. Then to Westover Field, Mass. Salt Lake City is where we got our crew. We got all the crews. That's where they formed all the crews.
So you, from Fort Devens to Salt Lake City, what period of time was that approximately?
6 months, 9 months.
What did you like or dislike about all that training?
I liked it. I mean, I wanted it, you know. I enjoyed, not that I enjoyed it, but I accepted it as such.
Once you were you tested to show that you would be a good flight engineer?
Well, they give you an exam, colors, and they give you a thorough test, and I passed. I was a little above average, I guess, and they accepted me. You have to be pretty good. You have to be physically fit, naturally, and your IQ is going to be a little high. So it was. I was accepted. A lot of guys are not accepted, and they have to go into the infantry or wherever they go.
When you were in Salt Lake City and you were teamed up with a crew,
yep.
You didn't know any of them
no.
until you were teamed up. And then from there, did you go overseas?
No. Well, from Salt Lake City, we went back to Westover Field, Mass. Now, we were a crew, regular crew now. We had four officers and six enlisted men. And I was being trained on A-20s. That's a medium bomber. I was trained for them, and so when we get going again, they put me on a heavy bomber, a B-24. That was 10 guys. On the A-20 is about four or five guys, six guys. But on the B-24 Liberator, there's 10 guys, 10 fellas, four officers and six enlisted men.
When you were trained, what exactly does an engineer on a flight engineer do on a B-24?
Well, he has to transfer fuel when it's ready, you know, because you got four engines going, and the tank, you got a lot of the tanks are in the wings, and you got to transfer, you know, when the time comes, you have to transfer fuel. Anything breaks, or it's up to you to try and repair it, you know, up there, you know. You're 4 miles up, and it's 22,000 feet.
And were you on oxygen?
Oxygen all the way. Our pilot, the crews, after we were overseas, a lot of the crews, when they get in their plane, they took off and went up to about 5,000 to 10,000 feet. Then they put their oxygen on, because up to after 10,000, 15,000, then you need oxygen. But they put it on like 10,000 feet. They put the stuff on, all the armor and all that stuff. So my pilot says, my pilot was a West Point graduate, a wonderful man. My pilot says, well, you will put your equipment on the ground while you, as soon as you get in your plane. So what if we're starting to go up and we're being attacked? You won't have time to put that stuff on, and you know. So he was true and all that. So as soon as we get on, we put their oxygen on and the armor, the Mae West, in case we over the channel.
And know. Tell us what a Mae West is.
It's a vest that you inflate if you're in the water. And if you had to go in water, you inflate and it keeps you afloat.
So after you...
And you put that on, after all the harness, the parachute harness and everything is on. Because if you put that on first, then you put all the harness on and you try to inflate it.
It tightens everything
so,
up.
Yeah, you can. You put the Mae West on after.
After. Once you trained with your group of 10,
yeah.
How long did you train with them before you went overseas?
Well, like I say, Salt Lake City started it.
Yeah.
From there to Westover. Mm-hmm. And then we were assigned, we were a crew. We were regular, and we were buddy buddies then, you know.
And you did all get along well?
Oh, yeah, we had it well, sure.
And from Westover, you knew eventually you were going to be going overseas.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Did you think you were going to Europe, or...?
We didn't really know at that time. And I'm glad we went to Europe. I didn't want to go to South Pacific.
And when did you go to Europe? Do you remember?
Well, when we got over, we had Gotwick Bay, Scotland. Then from Scotland, we went to Stone, England. And from Stone, England, we went to our base, which was Attlebridge, which is Norwich, England. And that's up the north, way up near the North Sea. That was our base. That was all B-24s up there. And on south of us was all B-17s.
So when you say all B-24s in this base in Attlebridge, how many B-24s approximately?
Yeah. Well, there's 12, usually about 12 or so in a squad. And we had a lot of squads. I really don't know.
And you were part of a squad?
Oh, yeah.
And what was the name of your group?
The Ruptured Duck.
The Ruptured Duck. That was the name of the plane?
That was the name of the plane, and we had it on our jackets. And my radio man painted the ship, both on the nose, both sides, and all our jackets, he put the Ruptured Duck. Now, the Ruptured Duck is a duck floating down with a parachute. I'll show you a picture. And he's floating down. This is a duck now floating down, and a bomb comes up right through here, and you see feathers flying. So he got ruptured duck.
That's great. And what was your unit? What was your unit?
What do you mean?
The name of your unit. I believe you told me prior to going on camera, you were with the 466.
Yeah, 466 Bomb Group.
Well, if you repeat that on camera, the 466,
466
Bomb Group.
Mm-hmm. 787 Bomb Squad.
And you mentioned earlier your pilot, who was a good man, and did he treat all of you equally?
Oh, yes. He was strictly in the air, it was business. All on the ground was a little different. We call him Bud.
Bud?
Budweiser.
What was his
name? His name was Louis Weiser from Indiana. From Indiana.
And W-E-I-S-E-R?
Yes.
Weiser. And you said he was a West Point grad.
Yeah.
So would you fly out of your base in England?
Yeah.
Did you know ahead of time where you were going going to? Tell us what a typical day
would be
like.
Well, when you're going to fly, they get you up about 6 o'clock, 5, 6 o'clock, They take you over to the mess hall. You have a little eat. Then from there you go to a big room, an interrogating room. It's a big room, and they have a screen and maps and all that. And we're all in there, all the La Mayan 747 squad, maybe 12 planes from us. There's 10 in each plane. We're all in there. This squad's there, that squad. It's quite 200 guys in there. And so the officer comes up on the stage and he shows you the map where you're going. You know, he tells us just what you can expect. A lot of flak, heavy flak, or it'd be a bomb, a milk run. But they usually are not milk runs. He says they are, but we're always getting hit. You know, fighters or flak.
So you'd finish up there and you'd all take off?
So after the interrogation, the trucks takes us over to our planes. And like I told you, as soon as we get in the planes, we put all our harness and we're at our position, you know. And then the pilot comes in and all that, and then we take off. Now we're in line, we're following the people in front of us, you know.
What time of year was the beginning of this?
I don't know. I know it was Christmas. One of the missions was on Christmas. St. Lo. St. Lo. We hit St. Lo and it was Christmas Day. It was snow on the ground. Now, I forget what mission that was. It was the 6th, the 7th, something like that.
How many missions did you do?
I did 16 very hazardous missions. And then I got hit.
Before you got hit, because we'll get into that in a minute, your first time up,
yeah,
knowing that you might hit some flak, you're a young man, 21, 22 at this point.
Yeah.
What were you feeling back then? Do you remember?
No, I don't know how to explain it, but you were a young fella, and you're doing your mission. Yeah, it's your mission, and you're looking way ahead. It's, you know, you're up 22,000 feet, and there's clouds under you and all that, and there's all the other planes are aside of you, you know, and so. And another thing is that we're the pilot's eyes, because you're 12 of us are flying pretty close. They want you as close as you can. So if this plane gets a little closer to you, you tell the pilot, evasive action at 3 o'clock. Then he'll fly the plane away like this, or whichever way the gunners tell him. You know, because we're here, like I say, we're his eyes. Because a lot of the planes will come up in front, because they're trying to get in position too. You know,
right.
They can't see you or something, and so we're the pilot's eyes.
Now, what was it like in the plane? You're in leather or canvas? What were you wearing?
Well, we have electric suits. Electric. A pants are electric. The jacket's electric. And you plug it in.
You actually plug it in
the
plane?
Oh, you have to, yeah. It's, like I say, it's 45 below zero at 22,000 feet. And we have nylon hand gloves. And on top of that, we have the electric gloves. So that if you had to fix the plane up there, you take your gloves off and you do what you have to do. But if you didn't have the nylon on and you just took your gloves off, your skin, you would touch the metal and it would stick, you know. So you'll make sure you left your nylon gloves on and you had to do whatever you had to do, and then you put that stuff back on.
Now, if something else in the plane broke, did you have to go to other parts of the plane?
Oh, yeah.
Was that difficult because you're in very close
quarters? Well, you're in tight quarters and you have all this harness on, not the parachute. Now, the parachute, I left it right on the deck, right aside of me. In case I needed it, I get it and you clip it on and jump. But if I had to go in the back or to the tail, it's close. It's pretty close. And you're going to watch, you know, you're going to watch what you're doing.
Now, along with you as an engineer, you had gunners as you mentioned.
Well, I was
and you were a gunner also. So along with being the eyes of the pilot, fixing things that might not be working appropriately, you also had to shoot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, that was our main fact. That was our main purpose, was protect the plane.
So St. Lo, talk about St. Lo, because that was...
That was one of the ports that we had a bomb, and we went down pretty low. I don't know, we went down pretty low, and we could actually see the guys down below on the ground shooting at us with their rifles. Not that they would be lucky or something and they hit the pilot or some of them, but we could see, and that's how low we were. I don't know why we went down that low, but we went down that low and we took off and we bombed and we come back.
16 missions over what period of time?
Well, probably 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah, something like that. 9 months, 6 months.
And when you weren't on a mission, what were you doing?
Well, if we didn't have to fly that day, we'd go down, we could probably go to London on the weekend. We'd go to London, take the bus. The bus will take us to London. One time I had 3 or 4 days off. We went to Scotland and looked around, and then come back.
Did you write home a lot?
Oh, yes. V-mail.
And tell us about V-mail.
Well, you write it in this little package, a little envelope and they V-mail it. They send it home. I have a few of them at home. I left though.
And was it easy for you to get mail from home, from your wife and your family?
Well, it wasn't easy, but we get packages. I mean, some guy got a package and got some cookies or something, and then we'll all leave. See, we were a crew of 10, of six. The enlisted men were six of us. The officers had their own quarters. We were, we used to live in Neeson huts. It's a metal hut with a potbelly stove. And it would burn soft coal. And now the kids, the English kids, little kids, would come over and we'd give them their laundry or such that we need. And they'd take them home and have their mothers or somebody wash them and bring them back. And we'd give them apples and oranges. They're all rationed. They never saw any of that. So we'd be pretty good to the kids. So then we tell them, we need some coal. So we used to burn soft coal in that potbelly stove. And they used to go and steal it from someplace.
And get
bring
it for
us,
you.
They bring us the coal. So we used to reward them,
Now, when you mentioned going into London, did you see a lot of the devastation that we hear about?
Oh, definitely.
How did that impact you? What do you remember about it?
I hope I'm not in a hotel or drinking at a beer and the buzz bomb. They were shooting buzz bombs. The Germans were shooting buzz bombs.
And tell us what a buzz bomb is.
A buzz bomb is a rocket, like a rocket, with a shot. Two shot wings. They had little wings on them, and a rudder, and they were. And it's a bomb, and it had a gasoline engine in it. So they would, and how they shot how they launched them was a big long. This was in France, right on the coast. A big long chute, big long chute, 15, 20 foot long, 20 foot long, about. 2 foot wide, like a chute, so that they would put so much gas buzz bomb. The buzz bomb would take off on the chute and take right off, go over the channel, and when the gas let go and used all up, the bomb would drop, and they don't know where. Whatever it hit, it blew up. I've talked to a few guys. They said, "Boy, I was at this hotel, and we had to go to another hotel because they didn't have wine or something. So we went to the other hotel and had a little glass of wine. A buzz bomb came and dropped and killed and blew up that hotel.
The first one that they
so
were
at. So he says, from then on, I drank wine all the time.
Now, they call it a buzz bomb because Did it actually make a buzzing?
Putt, 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 putt.
So you knew?
It would putt, 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 putt. Now, we had, not we, but the English pilots, they're pretty clever. They would, the buzz bomb was coming over the channel. The English pilots would take off, and they'd get one on each side of this buzz bomb. And they'd not touch it, but make with the wind or with the breeze, they'd turn the buzz bomb around. And they'd go back over the channel and drop in the channel. Not many of them, but quite a few of them they did.
They were
a lot of them they
that.
Couldn't. They couldn't. It was too late, or, you know, it was
sure.
the gas let go and it would drop down.
Now tell us, with all your missions, you were in a direct combat, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And tell us about the 16th mission that you were
16th on. Mission? Mm-hmm. Well, before the 16th mission, we had one mission to go to General Patton. He's in tanks. And he went so fast that he ran out of supplies. He didn't have any gas and all that. And so we had to fly in gas to him. And the 5-gallon cans in the bomb bays.
And was he in Germany at that point?
Oh, yeah. He was. If you had let him go, he would go right through Russia. But anyway, not only my plane, but quite a few other planes, we had to supply him with gasoline. And another mission, we had to fly food, boxes and boxes of food, to Holland. Now, Holland was under German control. They were starving there. And so we dropped the boxes of food. And one little incident I'll tell you before that. My wife and I, after the war, we went to the Dutch island. Oh, I can't think of it, but it's an island. The Dutch owned it. So anyway, we're at the hotel, and there's a lot of GIs there, Dutch GIs, you know, English or whatever they were. So we got to talking and all that, and I said, geez, you know, I used to drop food to your grandfather, your father. You did? They used to feed drinks to me. I drank all day, all week long, free.
Well, because they were so thankful your help.
Oh, these were kids, you know. Yeah. I was a grown man.
sure, yeah. And any close calls leading up to your last mission?
Positively.
Tell us about some of them.
Well, each mission, you know, some missions we'd go and we don't see any ACAC. Oh, the ACAC was all further on. We never got hit, and we went in, there's no fighters. We went in, dropped the bombs, turned around and come home, no problem. Because every time we come back to the base, you have to land. When you land, you go into an interrogating room, like this, a big room, all the guys are in there, and you tell the interior, first of all, he brings in, it's an officer, he brings in a fifth of whiskey with glasses, and he'd pass them out to you, you know, just to calm you down and all that. My radio man didn't drink, so I drank his, and mine. But they'd ask all kinds of questions, you know.
What were some of the close calls that you would have?
Well, there were.
And what was it like also? You're in this tight formation. Yeah. Obviously, you were seeing others shot down.
They're blown up. They're right inside of you. They're blowing up. A lot of them, a friend of mine was in a plane inside of me. He was on the same outfit. So I asked for a couple of the guys to watch to see how many chutes come out of that plane. And about four or five chutes come out. And then the plane blew up. Another one, the plane, you'd be fine. One day, we used to drop chafe. You know the silver paper you put on a Christmas tree?
Yes.
You know, the chafe? Well, this used to come in packages about this big. We had boxes like this, 20, 30 boxes, or not that many, but they're on a plane. And on the side of the plane, we have a little opening this big, 3 or 4 by 4, something like that. So you take a package out, and you put it in that little hole in the fuselage, and the wind stream would take it, and it would trickle down, and it would foul up all their radar, you know, the radar screen down below, for their ACT-ACT shooting at us, you know. So we'd, like, sometimes they shooting and the plane shell would explode pretty close, and it would, you know, rock the plane, or it would scratch the side. We said, oh, so we'd, geez, we'd throw out more, get more.
So when we've seen pictures dating back to World War II where there's been that, yeah, it almost looked like stringed paper,
yeah,
that was silver, chafing?
Silver, like chafing. Silver paper. Mm-hmm. And that would trickle down, and, you know, they have a radar screen with their guns, you know, and it would screw up their radar.
Yeah. Anything that would help.
Anything.
Right.
Yeah. All right, then, one time we're flying, and the front of our plane got hit. We thought it was, oh my geez, a bomb. The guy in front of us, the plane in front of us, he threw out the whole cardboard box. He threw it out, and that hit our nose and broke the nose. And we said, you jerk, you're supposed to take the little packages out and throw them out. He got so excited, he threw the whole box out.
Which could have...
Well, it could have... If that hit the pilot or the window shield of the pilot and smashed the pilot, you know...
But you made it back to the base okay? Or did you have to do a special landing?
Oh, no. We made every day, every mission up to the 5th, up to the 16th, every 5th, you know, the 15th, and we went back to our base. We got over the... Our routine was to go over the channel, come down from North England, come around London, go over the channel, go through France. Now, it all depends on where you're going to bomb. My first mission was Munich, Germany, which was 5 hours in, drop the bombs, and 5 hours back. So, like I say, every morning, every mission you do, you go over the channel, and then in France, Germany, Berlin, Hamburg. One day we were dropping, we had to bomb Hamburg, Germany. And we're going parallel with Hamburg, which is right there. So we're going this way. And there was all kinds of flak. When they shoot a shell and it explodes, it's a black puff of smoke. So when you see black puffs of smoke, the bomb has already exploded. So we looked over, and there's the whole wall. They're all full of black puffs of smoke. They said, oh, my God, I'm glad we're not going over there. We're going this way, you know. All of a sudden, we turned. The whole crew, all the planes turned, and we went right over Hamburg, Germany. We dropped our bombs, and we turned around and come back. So you come back out through Germany, France, over to the coast. Then you go up to Belgium, you go through Belgium, and into Holland. And Holland is where we turn to go over the channel. So you're sort of a little relaxed then because you're almost on the channel, you know. But
in safe quarters.
Well, yeah.
You hope.
You take some of your junk off, you know, and all that. But the day I got hit.
What day was that?
August 15th, 1944. Where the hell were we? We were bombing an airfield. And we went in.
Where? In Germany?
In Germany. Mm-hmm. We went in and dropped the bombs. And coming out, okay, no problem. There was a lot of flak, but we could hit with the flak, but it would scratch the plane or nothing would damage the plane. And we'd come in over from Germany to France to the coast, up through Belgium to Holland. Like I say, there we're going over the channel. And we were sort of relaxing, like, well, we had, and all this mission, we had fighter escort with us all the way, over in the Hamburg, the airfield, and come back all the way right up to Holland. And that's where the fighters, our fighters, left us, because we're almost, you know, going over the channel. Soon as they left us, 28 German fighters were waiting for us, and they come down. Soon as our planes left, our fighters, they come in, and they knock down three bombers right off the bat. I was in the second Second bomber, second lead. They come down again. In the meantime, don't forget the lead plane is calling the fighters, come back. Because they went way down. But on the way up, see, in the second time, the German fighters, they formed again. They come down, they knocked down another three bombers. Well, that's 60 guys. There was 12 of us, 12 planes. We were lagging behind the big group of 1,000 airplanes. We were sort of lagging. That's what they call stragglers. We were stragglers. They were forming again the third time. In the meantime, our fighters come up and dispersed them. In the meantime, we're firing, and that's when I get hit. I was that day I was in the waist. The gun on the waist window. And the shell, they were shooting 20 millimeter cannons. We were shooting 50 calibers. I get some in there, show you. A 50 caliber, how big a 50 caliber is, this big. And an explosive. In other words, it hit the plane and explode. Well, when I get hit, they were shooting, it hit one right underneath the window, right on the right. It hit that, exploded. The nose of the shell is as big as your thumb, went right through me, right on the side, went through the intestines and out the pelvis, and broke all the pelvis. And the shrapnel, all this shrapnel, besides the nose of it, hit me in the leg, almost cut my leg off. I got 7 pieces out of here, 2 pieces out of here. That was the shrapnel. The shell went through, and my bone, I guess, my pelvis slowed it down, and it fell on the deck. So that's why I still have it. They found it, and they gave it to me. So I got hit, and I called the pilot. I called him. I told him, hey, bud, I'm hit. So I tried to get back up onto my gun. I kneeled with my knees over to the gun. I tried to pull myself up. I couldn't, so I just laid there. So the right race gunner, he was firing his gun and my gun, and all the hot shells were falling on me. Not that I felt them, but I was losing my blood. I was losing blood. I was passing out back and forth. So after we got over the channel, over them from France up to Holland, up to Belgium, Holland, and then we're turned and we're going over the channel now. So he called, just told all the guys, throw out what you can, throw the guns out, throw everything out of the plane to lighten up the load. Because we're going down. The plane was hit pretty bad and we're going down into the channel. So, and I'm just laying there, right? Nothing I could do.
Were you the only one that was physically hit at that point?
I was the only one hit that mm-hmm. load. And the left waist gunner came over and he was holding me while going over the channel. And I closed my eyes and he thought I was gone. But he tapped me on my helmet and I opened my eyes. And but anyway, going over the channel, they had to throw everything out. They were going to throw me out too. The radio man was going to parachute with me out. But if I did, I never would have made it anyway. But they didn't. We made it over the channel pretty good. We were over, we got over to England, the coastal of England, and over the cliffs of Dover, over the mountains, and over and down. And our field was 15 miles from there about. And he landed, and in the meantime, he called all the guys that got up front and up the flight, on the flight deck. Because if the plane, when we crash, we're going to crash, and usually the plane blows up. And so as soon as we stop, jump out, run, So we went up over the cliffs on the field, and they had to crank the wheels down. We didn't have any hydraulics, no electric. The landing gears, they had to crank them down, and you need a lot of power for them to lock. Well, they didn't lock, they just went down. As soon as we hit the deck, the wheels collapsed and we're on the belly. And we're going off the field, off the runway, through the field, and then into the woods. And in the meantime, the ambulance is following the plane. because we're on our base, you know, at the outskirts.
And they knew.
Oh, yeah, they say injured because when we're coming in, you shoot flares, different flares meaning different things. Engine trouble, people wounded, you know, and all that. So the ambulance would follow. So we get down and we went through the into the woods, and the trees are what knocked the wings half and half, and we stopped. And the plane didn't blow. I wouldn't be talking to you today.
Right.
But the radio man, the tail gunner ran out, and he ran into the woods. They had to chase him. He went a little berserk. But they got him anyway.
Out of fright.
Out of fright. He was about 18 years old, mm-hmm. 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And when they got me out, I mean, then when the plane stopped, they come on, and they had a bamboo stretcher. They put you in the bamboo stretcher, they lock you up, on the bottom where I was, there was a opening, you know, you open it up, and there's where they take you out of the plane, so the plane was up like that. So they took me out and they brought me into the ambulance to our field, to our base. The flight surgeon at our base saw what was happening. And he called for blood. He called for blood transfusions, you know, all in the field. Anybody, come in. I have all kinds of blood in me. But it kept me going until I can get to the hospital, which was 21 miles away. So they got me in there. I was knocked out. They got me in there. About 2 days later or so, I woke up and I saw, you know, young girls around the foot of the bed. And I'm saying, women, 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 are there any men around? They said, why, what's the matter? So I have to go to the bathroom. I didn't know how to put a duck, they call that a duck, you know. Mm-hmm. So then from then on, then about the guy that operated on me was a...
And this was in England.
This is in England, yeah. in England. The guy that operated on me was a colonel from World War I. His name was Lieutenant Colonel Pedro Plato. And he operated on me and he saved me because he had all the bad cases. And, I was still alive.
So what kind of operations did you have to have?
Well, way after, I talked to one of the corpsmen that worked on me. And he said, they cut you open from here to here. They open you up. They take out all the intestines, and they look for holes. You got 22 foot of small intestine. So they look for holes and this and that. He said they mended about 3 or 4 inches of it. All the rest of it was no good. So they cut it, and they put it back, they hooked it up again. And put it. So when I was teaching up at Waltham High, we're talking about that. I was saying something, and some of the girls, young kids, were saying, I says, I have to go to the bathroom faster than you do. Just something for a joke. You know.
And your pelvis had to be healed?
Well, yeah, that was busted. That was broke. They fixed that. Here, this here was up like this, and they took all the shrapnel. Not all of it, quite a few of it. They said, then later, I used to get lumps here and here and here.
It would be shrapnel.
The surgeon, whatever, he'd just nick it and take the shrapnel. The shrapnel would go way in and then eventually, you know, work its way out.
Travel,
you know?
Out. Now, what about your leg?
No, the leg was open. I can't show you, but a big hunk of the muscle was taken out. There's a big dent right here. And it was broke. The bone was broke. And they put it in a brace and all that stuff. This here they bandaged. I couldn't write, so the nurses had to write for me to my wife, you know.
Yes. What happened? How soon after you were hit and in the hospital did your family and your wife in particular hear? And how did she hear?
Well, telegram. Your husband has been seriously wounded. I will, I'll keep you informed and all that. And that's it. I still have the telegram at here.
And how Have you talked to her about how she reacted to that?
Well, the telegram came. I was living in Belmont at her house, her mother's house, at the time. So when the telegram came, my grandmother, my mother-in-law, don't speak. She can't read English. So she got the telegram. She knew the telegram. And I guess I think she had somebody read it for her, that I was seriously wounded and all that. But in the meantime, my wife was working.
Where was your wife working?
Hood Rubber.
And what was she doing?
Well, I think she was something about submarines. They were flat in the floats or something about that. So when she got home, two of her girlfriends were coming down the street, so she called her two girlfriends in to be with my wife. So she showed my wife, she gave them the telegram, and she read it, and she ran upstairs crying.
So you were in England, you were operated on Lieutenant Colonel...
Pedro Plateau.
How do you spell his last name?
Oh, I don't know. Plateau.
P-L-A-T-E-A-U or something? P-L-A-T-O? Plateau?
Plateau.
He saved your life.
Yeah.
How long did you stay in the hospital in England?
6 months.
And then did they transfer you home?
No. Yes, I come home in the hospital. Well, before that, Colonel Plateau came in about 3 months later, and he says, the war's going to be over in such and such a time. I said, nah, it won't. And so he came in that day, and it wasn't over. So he gave me a pound note, English money. That was worth $5 then. I don't know what it's worth now. But it's a pound note. And on the note he wrote, to Tech Sergeant Mueller, who had the guts to take it, this wager is gracefully paid. And he puts his name. Now, who had the guts? He took my guts out. That's what he meant. Yeah.
So you could maintain a sense of humor, but what was it like for you 6 months over there in the hospital, away from family, away from your buddies on the plane?
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
Well, at the beginning, I wanted to die. You know, they were putting tubes in me and this, and they were doing all kinds of, oh my Jesus. I said, oh, Christ, let me go, will you? But after, then it was, you know, I got better and all that, and I was okay.
Now, while you were there that 6 months, were you able to walk, ambulate?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. In the hospital, this other fellow and I, one guy was from Brookline, Mass. So there, we had all the rooms off this corridor, and then the big ward in the back over that side. So they'd come up with supplies, you know, a big cart, push a cart with supplies in each little kitchen, you know, they'd give them supplies. So he'd come up, this is about, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night or so, and this other guy and I would sneak out, and they would, was Nescafe coffee that was just starting to, so we'd steal it, you know. The guy didn't know it. He didn't care anyway. He came up. So the nurses knew we'd had the Nescafe coffee. So about 10, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, they come up and say, come on, Carl, let's have a cup of coffee. You know. So we'd go with the nurses into the kitchen and we'd have a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm.
But now, we recently interviewed a woman who was not a nurse, but was with the Red Cross.
Yeah.
And she said she would come in and write letters for veterans and you know, get gifts for them or help them. Did you find that was the case?
The nurses for us.
The nurses
I did. I had wonderful, wonderful, they were young kids. They were my age.
Yeah.
Nurses. One nurse was a little older. And she was from Plattsburgh, New York. And she lived with her grandmother and all that. So when I got home, I was in England for 6 months. After I come home on a hospital ship and all that stuff, they sent me to Atlantic City with my wife for a month. and to recuperate, or I don't know what they call it, but my wife. And my wife says, look at this on the tables. And this second floor was all married couples. They had chocolate, Hershey chocolate bars, and they had all kinds of stuff where back home, you couldn't have none of that, none of that stuff.
Because there was rationing. And
yeah, yeah.
When you say Atlantic City, was it a hospital base?
It was one of the hotels.
Okay.
We were on the second floor. It was a room, our room, and that was all married. It was a regular hotel. It's all the hotel. We took the military took over all the hotels, all the benches on the walk, on the boardwalk, and all that was for military personnel only. Well, that's all that was there anyway. So, I stayed there and I played ping pong with Donald O'Connell. Remember Donald O'Connell?
Singer dancing in the rain and all
I
of that.
I played with him, Donald, and he let me win.
Was he in the service also? He was visiting like USO or something.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He entertained the fellas.
Was he a nice guy?
Oh yeah, he was a young kid.
Yeah, yeah. So how long did you stay in Atlantic City?
1 month.
1 month. Okay. And then were you rehospitalized?
No. Then from Atlantic City, I come back home to Waltham, and from there I got orders to go to Plattsburgh, New York, to the Air Force Hospital. It was at Plattsburgh, New York, and that's where my nurse was. She used to live. So when I got to Plattsburgh, New York, I was assigned in the ward and all that. They're taking all kinds of tests and all that. I went to see her, and she gave me the address. So I went to see there was an old her grandmother, and I spent a couple hours with her talking and all that stuff. Because these young nurses, they would write to my wife when I couldn't walk, couldn't write. They were very, very nice. I met an English, this is in England. I met an English young girl. She was married and kids. So I wrote to my wife and I said, send some kids stuff, to this address. So she did. The only thing is, I didn't realize duty. She had to pay so much money to get that package. If I'd have known, I would have given her the money. But I did. I tried to do a good thing, and that was it.
So you then ended up. What was it like going over on the hospital ship?
Oh, it was good. I mean, not good. It was all right. It was okay. They were all. Not all injured, but there were a lot of guys coming home, and I was in a room with all the Air Force fellas. That's all.
Now, when you mentioned you had, let me just jump back a little bit. When you had the crash landing, you were the only one injured.
I was the only one injured.
And you all made it out of that airplane.
Out of that airplane.
Tell us, did they all make it out of the war?
No.
Tell us about that.
After I got in the hospital. The crew used to come and see me. And my officer came, and I'll tell you this one thing. This young officer came, the lieutenant, and I'm in bed. I was the only one in the room. Just at that for them, I was pretty serious and just one in the room. He came up to me and he came up and he's like that, and I had to sign some papers. So he came over. He started walking away. And he said, oh, wait a minute. He took his release and he took out the Purple Heart. He took out the Purple Heart.
Oh, show it.
He took out the Purple Heart and he flung it at me. Honestly, he was standing over here, so he flung it. So I didn't think nothing of it. But then when you get home and you hear about these guys standing in review and the general comes and puts the medal on them and all, I said, look at that. This lieutenant threw the damn thing at me.
Why don't we show it to those who are looking, because it's a beautiful piece. Why don't you hold it up this way?
And I think my name is in the back. I don't know.
Let's just hold it.
I think my name is in the back of that.
Can you see that, Dan?
Now, I got the Purple Heart, and I got three clusters with that.
Which is a big deal.
Well, because of the other wounds. I could hit with one shell, but then with the shell, all the shrapnel hit me all in other different places. So they give you one Purple Heart with three clusters, because I hit three places, my leg, my chin, my hand. And then the big one went through here. That's the Purple Heart one.
That's the Purple Heart
yeah,
one.
Yeah, these are the clusters.
Want to show those?
But this is the air medal. Every six missions, they give you an air medal.
If you show that, tip it and show it to the camera. That's beautiful too.
But I have three of these. Yeah. The other guy, they did see when we were flying, you had to do 30 missions, and you send you home. Like I said, I only did 16. So.
Now tell us about the rest of your crew.
Yeah.
You were the one injured in 1944.
Yeah.
The rest of them walked away.
Of that.
And
plane,
tell us yeah. about the rest of your crew after
well,
the fact.
Well, after, when I was in the hospital, I don't know, maybe a week, 2 weeks, and this particular day, the crew didn't have to fly that day for some reason or other. So my pilot, like I told you, was a West Point graduate. He was gung-ho. He was a major. He took a green crew out, another plane. Our plane was left, you know, behind it. Our men were relaxing, but he took this green crew out, and he stood between the pilot and the co-pilot in the back. And, you know, if they made a mistake, he'd tell them and all that. So they're over Germany. They're over France, and they got hit with shrapnel and blew the plane up. 15 of them got killed. Not 15 of them. The whole plane up, 10 of them got killed. And then him, that's 11. Like I said, then the radio, the tail gunner, he went berserk.
So did they help him? Did they put him in hospital?
Not
and
then.
Help
they
him?
Sent him home. They come home. He come home on a hospital ship with me. Come home, and then he went to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then that was the last we heard of him. And then we heard he was put away. You know. Mm-hmm. But he's okay now. He's mm-hmm. okay. There was one thing I was going to see. I can't remember.
Others on the on your plane.
Oh,
your crew.
When not only away from that, this is something else. On our crew, our whole crew, 10 guys. The pilot was a German Jew. The radio man was German. We're all Americans. He was a German Jew. German. The left waist gunner, the right waist gunner was German. I was Italian. And there's another German there. I said, Jesus, if they ever shoot us down, and they line us up and they'll say, well, they'd shoot every one of us right off the bat.
Now, of that crew, could any of them speak the language?
Oh, sure.
And you could speak Italian?
Yeah, but a little bit, not much, a little bit. But the German one, he lived in Newark, New Jersey. I used to go and see his mother, father there, German, you know, beautiful, wonderful. The pilot was from Indiana. I didn't go see him. I talked to his sister in Indiana, but mm-hmm. after he died, mm-hmm. was it?
So getting back to you then, you came back, you were at the Air Force Hospital in Plattsburgh for how long?
6 months.
So you were in the hospital for a
whole
year.
1 year. I got hit in August 15th, 1944. I was discharged August 14th or 15th, 1945. Now, the day of the discharge, the guys were doing everything possible to get discharged. They were saying different things and all. I said, so I said to myself, I said, well, you know, what can they ask me? What can I? So anyway, when the time there was going to be a discharge, These guys, I had to go up in front of three officers. They were, and I saluted them, and they says, "Soldier, what's your name? What's your serial number?" And I said, 1108-9972. That's it. Goodbye. And I was discharged.
And you were a sergeant at that time?
Oh yeah, tech sergeant.
So you're discharged from New York. Your injuries?
Oh, they were terrible. At home, I couldn't do. I was throwing up. All, you know, I was very. I couldn't eat. Like I like Italian food, and you can't. I couldn't eat it, like spaghetti and sauce and stuff. I can't eat it. Once a month, maybe, but I used to sneak it in. You know, I'd get sick and throw up and you know, all that stuff.
When you came back home, did you come back to Waltham?
Waltham.
With your wife?
Yeah.
What was it like coming home?
Well, I went to Belmont. When I come home, I went to Belmont with my wife's mother. And Waltham was putting up housing for the vets. So I put in for, you know, put in for one. And we had to wait. There were Navy barracks from Rhode Island that broke down and shipped up to Waltham and put up. So I got one of the Navy, I got one. And one of the apartments. And there I had my first daughter. I got out in 45 and she was born in 47, I think, something like that. And then we stayed there 5 years. And then I bought a home behind Murphy Army Hospital. You've heard of that, Murphy Army Hospital? It was a big 500-bed Army Hospital in Waltham. Now, when I left, there was no hospital. But when I come back, there was a big, big hospital, 500 beds. Now, they used to, from the Waltham train station, they used to come up near Bentley College, up that way, and into the hospital with the ambulance from the patients were coming in back and forth. And at that time, it was only a cow path. You know, the trees were touching. So the colonel called, get Washington, he got money and all that, and they opened up the road and made it wide, nice, so that the ambulance could come back and forth, back and forth. So then they were building right in front of that. There was a little development. So he built, there's 28 houses, all ranch houses. So I bought one, and all the other ranches, all the other fellas, they were all GIs. We were all military. So, like I say, we moved there, and then a year later, I had the other daughter, next daughter, and that was it. Two's enough.
And are you still in that ranch house, or?
I am still there.
Do you remember what you paid for it?
Yep, $12,000. And I had he took $1,000 off if I painted painted inside, you know, the living room and the, I said, yeah, okay, yeah.
So you're a year in the hospital, you come home, and within a few years after coming home, you start and have your family, you buy your first home.
Yeah.
Did you discuss with your family or friends what had happened to you or your experiences?
Well, see, a lot of the fellas don't want to talk.
Right.
I didn't mind talking. I don't know why, but I just talk. Once I get started, I just talk about it. I thought it was an honor. You know what I mean. At the time, I thought it was wonderful that I could get in there, and I joined the Air Force. That was just what I wanted. And I did my duty, and that was it.
Did you join any unit of the military reserve when you came out?
No.
Did you join any veterans organizations?
Oh, yeah, positively.
What did you join?
Disabled American Veterans, the VFW, American Legion. Those are the military ones.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Elks and a couple of other little other ones. You know.
Are you still active in those?
The VFW we are. We go, now the VFW in Waltham, we have our own club and all that stuff. Every third Thursday of the month, we go to Bedford Hospital. It's a group of us. And we take a 21-piece band with us, the Soft Touch. I don't know if you ever heard of them. Soft Touch, half of them American Legion, the band, you know. But they come from work, they go right up to Bedford Hospital. And we do. We all meet. And we're all there by 6 o'clock. We bring coffee, donuts. The women bring donuts and they wrap them up. We have coffee, ice cream, the hoodsies, and we pass those all out. But we go up, the fellas go up, the commander and I go up and all that, and the women come with us, as many women as we can. So the women, they pass out the stuff. We do too. Sometimes we have Boy Scouts there. They help us. They pass out.
And this is a veterans hospital.
Veterans Bedford Hospital mm-hmm. that's been there since World War I. Mm. But that's Norris, what's her name, Rogers, the congresswoman. But anyway, we go, like I say, we go there. And the women, when the band gets there, they play, start playing. The women get up and they dance with the wheelchairs.
You know, wonderful.
They push the wheelchairs around and we have... And then we pass out all the other the little goodies. Then at 9 o'clock, we're all done, and we go home. The band goes home and goes to bed and get up and goes to work. We go home, and you know. What I'm saying is they work all day, and they come there at night. It's beautiful.
Now, how, when you came back from being in the hospital and from the war and you were discharged, how soon after that could you work?
I went, let's see, now where did I work? When I got home, I had a Murphy Army Hospital was there. I never saw her. But I used to go to outpatient there for different things because they had an outpatient. You know, I was still in uniform, you know, still. So then I said, geez, let me see. Maybe I can get a job there. So I went to apply for a job. And I did, and I got a job there. I worked at the... As a laborer, I couldn't labor, but they hired me anyway. Mm-hmm. So then I worked, you know, I got to do different things, and I got on the bulldozer, I got all the equipment. I ran all the equipment, which is sort of not easy, but it wasn't pick and shovel, you know. So then I got to be foreman of roads and grounds. And I had a crew of 12 guys and some of the custodians. But I stayed there. I went in there in 1946 or 7, and I retired in 1983. I had 40 years service. 40 years, that's with the military and the civilian government. And I had 1 year sick leave. A lot of the sick leave that I never used, that they gave me 41 years in retirement. See?
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
Did you receive any benefits, hospitalization, GI Bill benefits?
Well, I used to go to the VA,
right,
which was at 17 Court Street, Boston. I had to take the trolley, and every time I had to go there, they were treating my hand. It was all swelled up, and my leg, and... They give me different medication, you know. But I had to go at least once a week. And that's, like I say, take the trolley into the Harvard, and then from Harvard to Knott Station. And Knott Station, you had to walk up to Washington Street or West Washington. That's where the VA was.
Do you attend any reunions with your old crew and outfits?
Yes, I did. About 2 years later, I went, we had a reunion in... In fact, it was in Cambridge, Mass, in one of the big hotels. So I was there. Then 5 years later, we went overseas with my wife and I. We went to England. We saw.
So you say 5 years after the war, you mean? Or
yeah, after okay. I got discharged, mm-hmm. Yes. We went to England. And
what was it like going back?
Well, it was good. I mean, the people appreciated it, and they showed it. They'd see you walking down the street, my wife and I walking, and I said, oh, geez, watch this. He's going to hit us up or something. Thank you, Yank. Mm-hmm.
How important to you was serving in the military?
Very. Well, very, very. That was our duty, and we did it. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. I wasn't like a few of them. They used to run off and go to Canada.
Do you feel in some way it affected your life and how you moved forward in your life?
No, but I'm still talking about my military history. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I go to Bentley College. The Professor Gere, Richard Gere, now, not the movie actor, but that's his name. He calls me, and he asks, and I said, well, you want me to wear my uniform? He says, oh, my God, yes, yes. And the students would come in. Like, a few times I have to go, like, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's an hour and a half class. And then he has another class, half past two, and I had to wait around, have coffee, and then at 2:30, have another class. So I stayed there. Well, and he loved it. Then I used to get letters from them saying, thank you, you know, and this and that and all that. Not letters, but card with everybody writing on it, you know. Then I had one at Waltham High. They had one at Waltham High, which two classes. Two big classes down there. Oh, my God. I said, oh.
You tell them your experiences.
Oh, yeah, that's all. And they say, what are you doing? I said, I just tell them what happened to me, that's all. You know, what else could I say?
So many years went by that you weren't asked. And do you see, as I have seen, that since such things as Tom Brokaw's book, Saving Private Ryan, and things of that nature that have sort of highlighted the Greatest Generation, that more people, younger generation, is more interested in your stories.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and another thing I noticed too, lately, young girls, more so than men, than fellas, young girls thank you.
They
thank
do.
Me.
Yeah.
A few of them, now I go for breakfast every morning. There's a few guys there, they're from Canada. They're here, they're citizens, I guess, I don't know. But they always, hey, Carl, hi, Carl. So come Veterans Day, they buy me breakfast. They said, this is thanking you for what you did.
That's great. Now, you also mentioned before we went on camera that you meet at Hanscom Field.
Yeah.
Who meets there with you?
We go once a month. The 16th of the month, it's on a Thursday, we meet at Hanscom Field at 11 o'clock. Now, who they are is a B-17 crew, a crew of B-17 that flew the B-17s. We have a couple of Navy guys there. Now, they're not Air Force, but it's open to any, you know, all of us. But most of them are all Air Force. And a couple of Navy guys, you know. Like one time we went on a group, we went to New Bedford up there where all the battleship Massachusetts and all that. So he's Navy, and he was telling us all these things and all about the Navy. We didn't know nothing about them, you know.
So it's a get-together that
you
have.
It's a get-together. We have a meeting. We have a regular meeting and all that. It's a club, you know. Mm-hmm. We have to pay dues, and we get a magazine from National, from the, you know. It's very, very nice, very nice.
You've certainly shared a lot of memorable experiences and characters with us. Anything else in particular, a memory that you haven't brought up? Information about a particular person or anything like that?
No, you've
covered quite a bit.
Yeah.
Is there one other thought or anything you'd like to leave us with as we finish up this interview?
I worked at Murphy, not Murphy, Mass Hardware. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's a hardware store, big one. Well, the president of the hardware store used to be a kid that where we used to live, on the corner, the guys in the corner, you know. We were big guys. Oh, my. These little kids were there. We get out of here. Go home. Get out of here. That was one of the president. So when I retired from the government and all that, I went to see him, and he says, I want to, you know, for a job. And he says, what, you want to start right now? Go ahead, start. I said, no, give me a couple of days, you know. So I was there, I think, for 22 years with him.
With Mass Hardware?
Mass Hardware. Until they closed.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. So then civilian, Waltham has that program to help them, senior citizens, you know, the program to work so many hours.
That helps you with your tax relief?
Yeah, they take one quarter of my tax out. You get four quarters, and they take one per. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years.
And where did you work?
Waltham Hospital, Waltham Police Station, yeah. In the computer room. The sergeant that was in charge, he was went to school with my daughter. But anyway, the computer room where I recorded all the. When a policeman makes an arrest, he has to write a big sheet of paper, you know, on the paper. And there's thousands and thousands of these papers. So I take them all and I put them on a disc, small disc. So when the lawyer comes in for that, one of those cases, he'd look at the disc and see it, and there's all the information right on there. All these papers here, they destroy, they get rid of. So that was my job for about 3 or 4 years. Beautiful, I loved it. And you can go in anytime you want, you know, and all that, as long as you make up the hours. I forget right. What the hours were. But now I replied again for this year, and they called and they wrote a nice letter. There's so many applying for these jobs, the senior citizens, you know. That you make a little bit too much and we can't hire you. Mm. So I says, oh. My daughter was mad. She says, "What do you mean?" She says, "You're in your age and you're a senior citizen and all that. You shouldn't be able to pay. You shouldn't be paying any tax." I said, "Hey." I miss it.
Well, you're certainly a credit not only to your generation but to all generations in your. Your activities and your continued activities are remarkable.
Yeah.
Carl J. Mueller, we want to thank you today for coming in and sharing your story with us.
All right.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.